Welcome to Who Knew? We are fans of the current series of Doctor Who, and here we discuss our likes, dislikes, and insights into the modern regeneration of the show. Subscribe, review, and listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher, or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast. All our episodes are on WhoKnewPodcast.com. You can leave comments there, or email us at WhoKnewPodcast@gmail.com. We also have an Instagram and Twitter account. Tweet at us at WhoKnewPodcast, and find us on Facebook.
Hi, it's Eugene here, and we got Matthew Jacobs and Vanessa Yule, part of the Doctor Who Am I movie documentary coming out soon, right? So we talked to Matt before, but Vanessa, can you tell us a quick version of how you got into Doctor Who?
Well, I got into my first experience with Doctor Who was in the 80s when my father, who's a big sci-fi nerd, found this quirky British TV show. And I remember being a kid and being fascinated by this guy. He travels around in a phone booth and all the wonderful quirky things that I remembered. And it was Tom Baker with the scarf and the funny hair. But I didn't really follow Doctor Who when it came back. It was actually Matthew is the reason why I was reintroduced to Doctor Who. I'd worked on a couple of his features before, and we were friends. And it was sort of over passing. It was after the 50th, and he'd been getting invited to conventions. And he sort of, I'm like, why are you being invited to Doctor Who conventions? That's just weird. And he's like, well, I wrote the Eighth Doctor. And I'm like, wait, what? So I didn't know about the TV movie. I didn't know about any of that. Matthew never talked about it. And so it was then Paul McGann. I found the TV movie online and I watched it there and I loved it. We were filming within 2 months of our conversation. So then it was, I quickly got into it.
Wow.
Yes.
Real quick, that was my first introduction to like Doctor Who, because I've only seen like print of Tom Baker in magazines. But that TV movie was my first introduction to a full-on dedicated 2 hours.
Yeah, and I mean, watching it now, it's fantastic. My mom has watched it, and she's like, oh, this is so great, you know?
Just a lot
of fun. Lots of great one-liners, you know, Eric Roberts as the master. I mean, Matthew was sort of explaining to me about all of the controversies of the movie, and I just couldn't believe it, really. Like,
yeah.
So I mean, Matthew, you take it away. I mean, it was just sort of like why he was being invited to conventions is kind of funny.
Well, it was interesting. After the 50th, I started getting invited to conventions, and I had been invited to a very strange convention in Jacksonville, Florida, which was going to be Colin Baker, me, and Dr. Puppet. I had pictures of this being sort of alligators and Doctor Who fans, and I just didn't want to go. And that's what I was telling Vanessa. And it was Vanessa who was saying, you know, oh my gosh, that's a good story because you don't want to go. And she was right.
Matthew's really funny. He's great on screen, you know. So the documentary itself, it follows Matthew, and he's quite a character. Like, I always say he's kind of like a Ricky Gervais, Larry David type. Throw him into, like, Doctor Who fans. Like, you know, what's going to happen?
What's going to happen? Yes, I think if you get the Doctor Who Am I, thinking that you're going to see a behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of the TV movie, you will be disappointed, because that's not what it is. What it became was really... my journey into fandom, because as I set off on this journey, I didn't believe myself to be a fan. By the time I finished it, I had found a form of fandom, and I also had found a form of regeneration, because we didn't just go to one convention. You know, we went to a couple of conventions, we went different times, we visited people in their homes. And yes, it's funny, but it's also hopefully people can recognize their own journey to fandom in it. And also we do explore other fans. We explore why they're doing. We explore the idea of how trauma can sometimes be healed by one's fandom, but that's not the only thing, obviously, that brings you to fandom. But it's certainly was for me in a strange kind of a way. And all these mysteries and more get revealed when you watch the movie.
Oh, that's good. Speaking of that, the trailer, when we had that conversation a couple of years ago, there was no trailer yet. So when the trailer came out, I was like, wow, this is kind of everything that you told us about. And even more, like, I felt very connected emotionally to that.
Yes, trailer. Vanessa. Well, it was one of those documentaries where Vanessa's the editor of the film, as well as the co-director and co-producer. And so Vanessa very much was the person who was sort of finding the story, and I think that the story didn't change that much from when I last met you 2 years ago. But bit by bit, we added little bits. Like, we brought in Eric Roberts, and Eric talks about, you know, the nature of passion and love, and, you know, he's talking with his wife there. So and in that respect, we stayed very true to where it was 2 years ago.
Then that brings me to Vanessa. Matt mentioned that it hasn't changed much from when you guys first started. Like, did it take a lot of time to kind of find that arc of the story?
Well, I mean, yes, when we were filming, we had no idea what we were going to, what the story was. So we're just like, film. And we met so many wonderful people. And, you know, some people did confront Matthew with some very honest opinions about, you know, half the doctor being half human or kissing his companion. And that's very entertaining. But certainly as we were filming, we weren't sure what happens, but there was a shift that happened in Long Island. I mean, we started filming this in 2015.
That's right.
This has been a saga.
Us. 2 years ago, we kind of knew where we were with it. Years that, you know, in by the time we got to 2020, and obviously it's truly an independent film. It is just the two of us. We are American Anorak. So when it took a while for it to start picking up festivals, and it picked up London Sci-Fi, and from London Sci-Fi, where it won the Audience Award, and from Melbourne Documentary Festival, where it got lots of great reviews, and it got attention from The Guardian and the press, we picked up a distributor in Britain, Kaleidoscope Films, and they in turn have picked up a distributor here, Gravitas, and so it's coming out March 28th on all good platforms in this country.
Yeah, is there going to be a theatrical release?
We wish.
But
we're going to do our best to sort of create, you know, a bushfire of people wanting to see this film. And in the UK, we had a very small theatrical release, but it was very effective because fans got together and sort of celebrated their fandom in a cinema, watching it. It was fun for them to see the TV movie on the big screen. It was fun for them to sort of recognize their fandom in American fans. So we're hoping, we're doing Boston Sci-Fi Film Festival, we're doing Gallifrey, we're doing Beloit International Film Festival, and hopefully a few other screenings. And if anybody out there has access to a cinema and they want to show the film, they should reach out to Gravitas and they can just, you know, rent it, show it for a very nominal sum and have an event with fans. I think that would, and they can do that now. You know, they should make that noise now so that Gravitas sort of starts to become aware of the fact that there is an audience that wants to get together to see this film.
Yeah. And on that nice pitch, Matt, nice pitch. But on that, so, yes, it's coming out March 28th, but then it's the 60th. The 60th yes. anniversary is in November. So will there be a theatrical? It really comes down to the fans. And we want, you know, or whoever falls in love with the film to just sort of, you know, get together, yes, at their local cinema. And, you know, some places have really reduced rates now just to get people in the cinema. So have like screening parties, because it's really a great film to watch with an audience. You get their big laughs. You know, every time we've seen it you know, in festival screenings or whatever else, are always, it's always interesting to see how they can catch the nuances and are just laughing, and then get quiet at a certain point where it gets very emotional and, you know, the audience goes quiet. So,
you know. Well, that means you've done your job as an editor. It can all be emotional, and then
I know. Where I'm like, they're crying. Yes.
Well, the Australian festival was pretty much a virtual festival because it was still very much COVID in Australia. So that was fascinating. We were doing a lot of time travel, and as much as we'd be here at some ungodly hour going on ABC on radio in Australia. But as far as American festivals are concerned, we showed at Newport. Our first one was Newport Beach, which is a very sort of ritzy, fantastic festival with, you know, lots of rich people. And then the other festival that was almost the same week that we dashed up to was in Portland, Oregon, which was much more sort of, was more of a fun festival taking place in an abandoned shopping mall with all sorts of other shocked filmmakers. We had a great time. We still managed to fill the audience, and we still managed to sort of have a great time. So those two festivals are good. And then we've shown at various conventions. What were the conventions that we've shown at, Vanessa?
Long Island, BritCon. Yes. We're going to be at Gallifrey.
Oh, and BritCon, yeah. And in Chicago. Chicago TARDIS.
Yeah.
And that was great, because that's like showing to people who are actually in the movie or know people in the movie. It's taken us so long to make the movie that sadly some people have passed, and certainly the carpet has changed
at Gallifrey One.
At Gallifrey. Are you coming to Gallifrey this year?
I don't know yet. Just because I, before you got on, Vanessa, I mentioned that I had just gotten COVID, so I'm kind of wary. I'm just getting over it. So,
oh, you should be good by mid-January or mid-February.
February is like good. Next month. I mean, next week.
You'll be fine. You'll be fine.
I hope to go, though.
It's a little scary going to these conventions because they are like petri dishes.
Yeah, they're very.
Yeah, so
like, yeah, Long Island was a great screening. I think it was like my favorite, and we were in this small room, or not, it wasn't a small room. It was like, you know, a medium-sized room, but it was packed.
Yeah.
And very intimate. Of course, we're both like, maybe this is when we get COVID. I don't know. But we didn't. And it was great. It was wonderful. There were so many laughs. It was nice because when people are closer together, it gives permission to laugh somehow.
Yes.
Whereas mm-hmm. when you're all so spread out, people are laughing and smiling, but you just feel more reserved, I think.
Yeah. So, okay, I'll do two things here, because originally we wanted to try to get this interview in December of last year, but then you guys were traveling, so I'm glad you got all that traveling done so you can talk about it. But then the other thing, maybe Matt can kind of talk about this, is that American television, like especially sitcoms, have that laugh track. And yes. to me, that reminds me that like we're supposed to enjoy these things as a community, as family, huddled by a TV, being the proverbial fireplace now, listening to radio, where I think it was somebody in the UK was like, American TV is so dumb. They have to have a laugh track so you know when to laugh. I'm like, I don't think there's a medium between those two extremes.
It is a bit of both. It doesn't mean that American TV is dumb at all. It means that all it means is that, I mean, in Britain, they definitely have multi-camera shows with an audience, but they don't use it quite as cleverly as American TV does. In American TV, it's filmed before a live audience. But as far as I know, they take the soundtrack with the laughs and they advance it just a few frames. So that the laugh will start really quickly. You'll really pick up fast off of a gag. So there is a degree of telling the audience at home, this is funny, this is funny, this is funny.
Are they still using laugh tracks?
Laugh tracks. It's always in front of a live audience, when it's filmed in front of a live audience, they have four or five cameras And they record it in chunks, and the audience is there, and the audience reacts, and the audience is part of it. It's a fascinating thing to go to.
We should have recorded Long Island and then did that as
a bonus feature. Yeah, laugh track. Yeah, why not?
Is it coming out on physical media? You should have put that as a special feature.
Running laugh.
Both Blu-rays, the Blu-ray that's available at the moment that people can get from UK Amazon is very basic. It's just the film. And in the UK, you don't have to, there's no law about providing subtitles. So if you're hard of hearing, don't get it. Wait for the American Blu-ray to come out, which will be on American Amazon around about the same time. But the Blu-ray doesn't have any extras at the moment. I think down the line, this is a perfect film for a later edition where we can put extras on there, because we cut little vignettes about all the people who we talked to that were kind of beautiful little, tiny little films in of themselves. We did one about Ken Deep. We did one about Daphne. We did all those early in the day. And they're like little portraits. And one day down the line, it would be nice just to sort of, we've been giving those portraits to the people so that they can look at them. But one day down the line, it would be great to have more extras on the Blu-ray.
Or just a commentary and a laugh track.
Yeah.
Commentary and a laugh track.
I mean, this is something I don't mind double dipping, you know, get the original release and then get the extended extra deluxe release.
Did you watch it? Have you seen it yet?
Not yet. I was kind of waiting to get like the podcast group to go to a theater, but right. That's not going to happen anytime soon, like in the March area. Might just get it and then we'll just hold our own viewing party.
Yeah, go to Gallifrey.
Or that.
it's definitely showing that. And we've been talking to American Cinematheque, and they've been talking to us about doing a double bill of the TV movie and the documentary, and, you know, to celebrate the 60th later this year. And I think that would be a fantastic thing to sort of really stir up some interest and fill either the Los Feliz 3 or the Egyptian.
That's a great idea. I don't know why they're not jumping on that.
Well, they he's keen. Grant Moninger, who's the guy who runs, who's the main programmer at American Cinematheque, is a big Doctor Who fan. And his first experience with Doctor Who as well was the TV movie.
Yeah. Yeah, going back to what you talked about, like all those little vignettes, like Vanessa, how much footage have you shot versus like you had to cut it down to what, 2 hours?
I need to go back and like actually, because people ask, and at one point I had the exact like hours and minutes. I mean, a lot of things were shot two cameras. So it was like a ballpark, like 80-ish minutes is what I'm saying.
80 hours.
I'm sorry, 80 minutes, the length of the finished film.
That would be cool. 1-to-1 ratio.
But yes, it was a lot. And we kept adding things over the years too. It's my first feature film that I've, you know, directed, co-directed, and first feature to have edited. And you know, Matthew is very adamant of, Vanessa, you have to put your own fingerprint on this. This is something you have to get to the end of like this process. And it, because it was quite daunting when you're just like, oh my goodness, I have all of this information. How do you, all of this footage, how do you put it together so it's like a story?
Right.
And it is certainly daunting at first. And that's when it was just like, okay, we both kind of made these little vignettes on people, but it's like, I always wanted Matthew to be the arc of the story, the framework, mm-hmm. and we're following his personal story. And he was, you know, he was reluctant at first, but.
Yeah, I didn't want to do that initially because I thought it was indulgent. But at the end of the day, Vanessa was right. It was the best way to tell this story.
Yeah, I was going to say that follows that story structure of reluctancy, acceptance, and then whatever the ending is.
You're right. Redemption.
Yeah.
Redemption, regeneration. Yes, it's in the spirit of the Doctor, of you know. The redemptive
arc is such a thing that we're familiar with. It's certainly there in things like Empress New Groove and other stuff I've done.
We were saying that Matthew is the llama.
Yeah, I was like, you know, Kuzco. I'm a bit of a dickhead at the beginning of the story, and then bit by bit, I learned the meaning of friendship with my funny friend Vanessa. and I don't know what, you know. I suppose is Paul McGann Isma? Is he Kronk? Is he, you know, what, there's parallels. We often tell the same stories over and over, not just me, but, you know, I think on films we're used to following somebody, and as we're watching the film, we're saying, oh, Eugene's really not getting it, is he? And then so we're rooting for him to sort of get it. And that's kind of the story that Vanessa saw, you know, because we were picking up things. We could have made short films about a lot of the individuals who we met, and there were all sorts of wonderful people. There was a person who was at Ground Zero 9/11, and we did a long interview with him, and he talked about how the firemen there would use Doctor Who as a sort of means of escape from the intensity of the work they were doing.
Wow.
And that was fascinating. But we couldn't include that. At the end of the day, there were stories like that we came across.
Right. I mean, we did talk about it. We wanted to incorporate it, because there's also this difference between like fans in New York or, you know, East Coast, West Coast, mm-hmm. and sort of just their attitudes and how they express fandom. And then the person who Matthew is talking about, I mean, it is powerful interview, but then we're like, oh, this is becoming, it's becoming too much maybe about 9/11 or something else. And we need to like focus on just these through lines.
Yeah.
So some the other day had asked like what ended up on the cutting room floor. And it's like, oh, there were just so many great interviews.
We chose a lot of stuff about Daphne Ashbrook, and she, there was more of her in the longer versions.
Mm.
And those, everybody had a little bit more. Somebody was asking me the other day, where did we shoot Paul McGann? Because they weren't sure. They said, oh, he's just in a garden somewhere. Did you go back to England to shoot him? Well, he's not. It's at Long Island Who, and Long Island, you know, has weather. And so we were out in the sort of misty back, a quiet place behind where the convention hotel was taking place, if anybody's wondering.
You're going to take it where you can get it.
Yes. Yeah. I was very nervous making him, wasn't I?
Yeah. It was like our first day of shooting in Long Island that morning. Yeah. And it was just like, oh, great. Okay. As a crew, we're just, all right. We're just going to get into this. First interview, Paul McGann. Have you had your coffee yet? All right. Here we go.
Man, you started off like really
high. Jumped in the deep end.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I haven't seen him really since 96.
Whoa.
So it was, I mean, the previous night we just said hi and he'd agreed to come and do it. And then we said, well, let's meet at 8:30, you know, whatever time it was, out the back of the hotel. And people could see us from inside the hotel. It was when we got reports later on, people came to the windows of their hotel rooms and could see us walking around with Paul. Paul's like sort of Yoda. He's sort of telling the truth and trying to give me some guidance and encouragement.
I mean, one of the things that we asked people about was like, who is the doctor in you? Or like, how are you the doctor? And everyone came up with their own very, very personal reasons, which I found surprising, because I kind of got into the 2005 series after we started filming, and for me it was kind of maybe a place of escape. I was getting, you know, my father had passed away the previous fall, and so for me it was like, oh, this is a safe place that I can go to, and oh my god, this is really fun and enjoyable. So I could sort of relate to those things. So here, bouncing the interview question back, hey Eugene,
what's the doctor
in you,
the doctor in you?
Well, I'll answer this with sort of other aspects, like the characters I normally gravitate towards are the examples, like Superman and Captain America, like the ones that I could never be, but who I want the ones to save me. Like, I don't want Batman to save me because he's going to terrify me. So right. I want somebody without a mask, which is Superman. Like, I'm your friend. Like that scene with Christopher Reeve in that first movie where he's like, who are you? And he's like, a friend. And like, that's who I want to be.
Yeah.
Right. Or I strive to be. So with the Doctor's optimism and like fondness for humanity, that humanity on Earth specifically mm-hmm. is worth saving. And no matter how many times we screw it up, he or she is going to be there. That's what I like about the show.
Yeah.
That's very good.
And it is that personal thing. That's interesting. I never thought about that, like a superhero with a mask versus no mask. But yeah. I'm vibing that. I agree. Yeah. If I saw Batman, he would freak me out.
Yeah, in real life, you would be freaked out because his whole motive is terror and fear, but for the bad guy.
Right.
But yet he's going to come at you with all of that. And you're like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
And the Doctor, just by that word, Doctor, is somebody who's there for you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a caring aspect.
Well, there's also a healer aspect and a fixer aspect with the sonic screwdriver.
Yes.
Like the Doctor wasn't given a
gun. Doesn't have weapons.
Can blow fire from his hands.
Even though sometimes the sonic screwdriver
does blow fire, but... I suppose he does. He does. I just was watching the new Witcher series, the Blood Origin or something, and chaos and stuff. But yes, he does blow fire, I guess.
But it's not the main purpose of that tool, because it's a tool and not a weapon.
That's right.
Right.
So that's why I kind of like Captain America, because they gave him a shield, which is for defense as opposed to offense.
Right. That's interesting as well.
It's funny being an adult and like, why do I like these things? Let me like ponder, and then here you go.
And we don't stop, do we? We've still got old wars happening. What's happening in Ukraine is an old fashioned war. It's the
Russians
very strange.
Are the bad guys.
The Russians are the bad guys. They need tanks. They're blowing each other up. I mean, it's almost like a throwback to the First World War. It's a kind of scarily familiar scenario that's being replayed over and over. Hey there.
Hello.
Howdy. Thank you for letting me join you. I apologize. I've just been listening into the last little bit of conversation. Sounds like you guys are doing great, have it under control. I don't want to stop the momentum.
I mean, like I kind of put in the email, it's more of a conversational interview. There's no real agenda. So
just chatting.
Yeah, just chatting. And then like kind of like you with your documentary, we're just finding the story as it comes along.
Yeah.
I've noticed that there's a lot of documentaries that are out right now that are similar to this sort of vibe of something that was from 1996, but we're gaining almost cult status, or it's becoming accepted in the pop culture zeitgeist. Like
like the Bowie one.
Yeah, there was the one that I really enjoyed was the My Nightmare on Elm Street, talking about this the second movie specifically.
Yes.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I'm gonna write that down.
Yeah, you should check. Okay, so when you think of the Nightmare on Elm Street, you will not think of the second movie because it is so different from what
is that
the
Dream
franchise...
Warrior?
No, it's the one where Freddy becomes the protagonist.
Is that Frank Darabont's one?
I don't think so. I'm gonna look it up right now, so I don't.
I can't remember whether he did Dream Warrior or which one he did. But yeah, that's fascinating. So somebody, you mean there are a lot of these films out here that are very specifically taking a small part of pop culture and saying, let's explore that and let's explore the impact of that piece of pop culture. Yeah, that's true.
So this one is called Scream, Queen, !! My Nightmare on Elm Street. And reading from IMDb, it's a retrospective of Nightmare on Elm Street on 2, Freddy's Revenge, and the life of the lead actor, Mark Patton. And kind of like similar to the Doctor Who movie, where it wasn't accepted as much.
Right. And then
throughout time, it's become more embraced.
I think it's fascinating, the films that don't go away. Often films come out and they are critically panned. Most of Stanley Kubrick's films got bad reviews. And then over the years, films sort of gain a status, they gain an audience, and they're viewed in different ways. And I think films, documentaries that explore that open people's mind to the sort of the way in which the culture of film is a flexible medium. And that's a good thing.
There was a movie that I watched while we were filming or in the process of this. It's called Best Worst Movie. And it's about a kid who was in Trolls 2.
Yeah. Trolls 1, it's weird. Trolls 1 has more of a budget, and then they did the sequel and they're like, what happened to the money?
Right. Yeah. Or they weren't even called Trolls. They were like called Gremlins or I forget. There was a funny thing. They're like, why is this called Trolls 2?
Mm-hmm.
But that Trolls 2 has become like a cult movie. I mean, I honestly, though, I think the TV movie is better than a cult. I mean, it is a cult movie, but I just think it's a really good movie.
It's not like a bad film. We watched it in Seattle. It plays it's a Britcom, and we watched it with Eric, with Paul. And it would have been lovely if Daphne had been there, but she unfortunately had COVID and couldn't come to this convention. And because she holds the film together, she's got this tremendous presence. And it played with an audience, watching it with an American audience. Was the first. It was fantastic to see. I hadn't seen that since the cinematographer's screening in LA in '96, and it was wonderful to see it work, and it works. It's a good film, but there's an interest in exploring aspects of popular culture that by itself, that interest has become a genre, which is what you're saying, Eugene. There are these documentaries out there that are doing this in a fascinating way. Val Kilmer's film, I thought, was great. Wasn't it? It was very affecting. And like our film, had a kind of a family feel to it. You know, there were home movies. You go and see Doctor Who Am I, you'll see my kids when they were little. And it had that feeling as well. So there's a personal aspect of these films about pop culture that I think is really interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Val is an interesting one. That was co-directed by Leo Scott and Ting Poo.
You worked
there. I never met Ting, but I know Leo. I worked with him for a while. And just knowing that was a project, I mean, the amount of footage they had to digitize, because he filmed his entire life.
On camcorders, no less.
Yeah. Like Amy, the documentary Amy, how everything was, you know, all archival. It's like, wow, that's a whole nother beast of storytelling when you have an archive that huge.
Yes.
And Doctor Who Am I, you're with us on the journey as we're finding the story. And you see the moments where we find where revelations happen. So it has that aspect as opposed to having a sort of godlike purview. You're with us.
Hopefully it's like a document. It's a documentary about making a documentary.
Yes.
You know, a little rough around the edges. We joke that, you know, you can always see the boom mic shot, you know.
Yes.
We hired some people, you know, we're in LA, they're in New York or whatever. We hired one guy who was just like, can I just be in front of the camera?
But he was fantastic. He got good sound. I think he took the attitude with, well, they're not going to tell me what they're going to shoot, so I'm just going to get the best sound I can get.
And I'm just going to stand right here. We're like, okay.
But in case he listens, he did a good job.
He did a very good job. Very good job. Great sound.
No, I think those are some of the best things, because I think that's why I started listening to podcasts, because you're kind of just a fly on the wall on a conversation. So you listen to, like, let's say a season's worth of a particular podcast show, and you feel like this guy is your best friend, even though you've never met.
Have you ever listened to Dead Eyes?
Yeah.
Yeah, Dead Eyes, which is a very pop podcast, is just brilliant. And that, likewise, is a sort of, a fly on the wall's view of something. The basic story there is this actor who didn't get cast in Band of Brothers and was told by his agent that Tom Hanks thought he had dead eyes. And he carried this around with him as an actor and decided to do a podcast about that. And so he interviews all these people and eventually obviously gets to interview Tom. And it's if you haven't heard Dead Eyes, I hate to sort of use yours to publicize something else. I'm just saying it the same as you, Eugene. These podcasts are fantastic. When I'm cleaning up my small apartment, it's, you know, I'll listen to Mark Maron. I mean, my gosh, he did an interview with Courtney Love the other week. That's just
you told me about
amazing.
That.
Yeah.
I think it's cool that so much now we're looking for community in our media, where before, you know, the tools were so expensive that you couldn't do that. But now we have, you know, the radio analog of podcasts and documentary films, and even feature films can be made with such inexpensive tools, but we're looking for that connection with other people. That's, I think, been lacking in many of our lives, especially after COVID. But what I liked seeing on the trailer for your movie is the family and the community aspect that I hope that you're going to show. I'm sure that you'll bring that out, but yeah, finding those connections in the families that we make instead of the families that we're born into is kind of our generation's journey.
That's a very good line. We should have used that.
Did you use that? Is that from your trailer?
I watched
it a while ago.
We say a family that's bigger on the inside, but what you just said,
no, that's
family that the family that you make is better than the one you were born into, or is different to the one you're born into. That's a good phrase.
Yes. It's the born into. Yeah. Okay. We might take that too. Write that down.
That's fine.
Yeah,
thank you.
Cause that kind of is relevant to the story of Doctor Who Am I, because I explore my relationship to my father, who was Doc Holliday in The Gunfighters. It was only after we made the documentary that I went, Doc Holliday, Dr. Holloway. It was like, I didn't consciously write, you know, Grace Holloway as a sort of rhyming name for Doc Holliday. That wasn't a conscious thing at all, but they certainly echo each other. The doctor comes to America and establishes a relationship with another doctor. Both shows. Interesting.
One doctor is a dentist.
Yes, one doctor is a dentist. The other's a heart surgeon. What can you do? And the other one's trying to take out a tooth, and the other's trying to find a bullet. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's obviously one gets stuck in a groove.
Well, they're similar skill sets. Tiny things being extracted from the body.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So I'm a reality television editor. So when you speak about mounds of footage, I enjoy having mounds of footage to go through, because usually if we don't have enough, that means we don't have the shots we need.
Use the shot again.
Yes, yes.
B-roll, okay.
I mean, you might touch on this in the documentary, but do you have any advice for aspiring filmmakers, whether they be documentary or narrative filmmakers, to impart? That's a pretty big question.
I mean, I guess don't give up. That's sort of keep good company. We're, as Matthew mentioned before, just a super indie production. We kind of went out with this can do, we're making a movie kind of gusto. Little did we know that would take over 7 years to like get it out there. It was the friendship, collaboration, just Matthew's probably the more glass half full. I can be glass half empty. So we kind of like, you know, to keep the motivation going and everything like that. So it was like having a good partner to be doing that with. And there are going to be dark times, but you know, you'll get there. Just got to get there.
You're dead right. I mean, it is that thing of, if you just keep knocking, eventually somebody's going to open the door. You don't know who it's going to be. You don't know what's going to happen. if you just keep knocking, just keep trying, eventually, you know, things work out. And finding your, you know, as Guillermo del Toro calls it, your film family is very important. That's wherever you are, be you at film school or be you just making films in your own time, collecting people around you who have like minds and who, you know, who can, you don't want to be alone doing this. Some people get off on that, but I think it's important, you know, to find your family. And I'm not talking from the fan point of view. I'm talking about it's like Vanessa and I started working together after I'd done a film for Bernard Rose called Boxing Day, and I was inspired by that film, which we made for very little money, British Film Institute film. We shot in Colorado with no budget, and it was just like Bernard with a camera, and me and Danny Houston. You can find this film, Boxing Day. It's an interesting adaptation of the Tolstoy novella, Master and Man. Very good. And it played Venice. So we made this little film on a Canon 7D. And there we were at the giant cinema in Venice showing this film. So shortly after that, I thought, well, you know, I was teaching at Academy of Art University in San Francisco, and Vanessa was doing her postgrad there, and Dylan Glockler, who shot Doctor Who Am I, was there. And Dylan and I,
on my documentary, An American Contradiction.
That's right. So Dylan, they were a team.
We were a documentary team.
They were already a team. And I had been hanging out with an elderly rabbi, Lawrence Kushner, and we would meet up on Monday evenings and smoke pot, and, you know, have a nice, very San Francisco. And just like, you know, teenagers, let's make a band, you know, let's make a movie. So I said, how much money have you got? I'll match that. You know, what would you spend on a vacation? And then we teamed up with Vanessa and Dylan, who were already a good documentary team. And we made our first film, which was Your Good Friend, which is also easy to get. You can see it on Tubi and on other
things. And what's the premise of Your Good Friend?
The premise of Your Good Friend is very simple. It's a recently widowed rabbi, played by a real rabbi, Lawrence Kushner, comes from Boston to San Francisco to find the apartment where he'd fallen in love with his wife. But living in the apartment is a washed up pornographer played by me. And the two of them need money, and they decide to make a website of clergy approved pornography. Which of course is doomed because they're both too old to make websites. It's a disaster. And then they get this documentary team. So it's a mockumentary drama. So they get this documentary team to film them in their attempt to do this. And that's where Vanessa and Dylan come in, and they're in the movie. Vanessa is there. Vanessa is also an actor.
It's been a while, but
and we occasionally act and do stuff. So it was fun. So we created that film family. Do you see what I mean? So it's like out of that, then we did Bar America. And then it just seemed very natural to do Doctor Who Am I. It was like we didn't think twice about it. So when we say in the movie, don't wait for permission, that's the credo we've kind of lived by. It can be risky because you don't really earn any money not waiting for permission. You don't get somebody to pay for it. So you have to do it yourself. But at the end of the day, if you've got an audience for what you're doing, it will work out. If you don't have an audience, that's fine too. You just make it for yourself. But basically, I think it's good if there is an audience.
Yeah. I mean, we kept telling people there is an audience. And even then, they were kind of like, not getting it, but we were right. There's an audience. Doctor Who fans.
Colin Vaines in London, who is a very good executive producer, was a big supporter, and he would be taking it around and drawing a blank with our documentary. And then in the end of it, it was Spencer Pollard and another the producer who picked it up from it winning the audience award, and they knew there was an audience. But you only need one person who believes it.
I think that, yeah, and that one person is really, I guess, Louis Savvy from the Sci-Fi London Film Festival.
Yes.
And then it's like the same week that we got London Sci-Fi in Melbourne, but up until that point, I was just spiraling, like getting really depressed. Like, we're not going to get into any festivals. Like, in my hometown turned us down. There was another one, the Cleveland, that had initially turned us down, and my film had shown there and stuff. And it was just like, no one's going to see it. But then we got into London Sci-Fi, won the audience award, had the Guardian article. Spencer Pollard from Kaleidoscope came through, and we're like, wow. Really, it's like kind of just you need that champion.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of conventions, like, had both of you gone to conventions prior to that?
The first one.
Okay. So this is all.
No. I mean, when we went to the first Gallifrey that you see us arriving at in the film, that was the first Doctor Who convention. It was the first convention that I'd ever been to. What about you, Vanessa? Had you been
I years ago had gone to an X-Files convention.
Yeah.
Very
so I've been to a convention before. That was my first Doctor Who convention. Yeah.
No, I think it's great that there's a convention for almost everything you can think of these days. It's really nice.
Yeah.
I was learning about balloon twirling. So balloon twirling is like, you know, when you have because there was this guy at Long Island who would make, you know, those long skinny balloons, and usually the clown makes a little dog or makes a sword. He was making these like gigantic sculptures of like, you know, the Sixth Doctor and these, you know, all these creatures from Doctor Who. And it was incredible. It was incredible art. And he was telling me all about balloon twirling.
Wow.
Balloon twirling. And there's like some convention in Glendale next month, like some competition.
Going to be your next film, wow, Vanessa?
Okay.
Are you going to go there and film that, Vanessa? You should.
I don't know if I'm, well, we'll see. I don't know if I want to be there. I don't know. It's not.
Maybe it's a sizzle reel.
Yeah.
It's still in development. Yeah.
Still in development. I'm so wary of starting projects without a budget. Because this one was
Sometimes you just have to have that sort of punk kind of courage. I think that's very much what Bernard Rose has. He's a filmmaker we work for. He made Candyman. He made Paper House. I wrote for him. We've both been in his films, and I'm pretty constantly in his films as well. And we're just really good friends. We meet up, we hike up into Griffith Park. And he has that kind of can-do thing of like, I'm just starting this. I'm doing it. We're making it. It doesn't matter. We did a film called Traveling Light that we shot during the pandemic with a bunch of actors who were all friends, you know, one of those films. And it was that kind of positive energy. At some point, you have to say, I'm going to just make this film. And then, you know, build it, and they will come. And then eventually you gather supporters. And hopefully, if there's an audience, it means that you will get some money to make it, because they will see some way in which they can make the money back. Otherwise, you have to get grants.
Yeah, or start selling your body parts, I guess.
I haven't done that yet. That's a good idea. Don't think you get much for my body parts.
You never know. There's a convention for everything.
Oh, buddy parts convention.
Yeah, this is turning dark.
That's really good.
Speaking of documentaries, there's one called Finder's Keeper, which is about
the brothers.
Well, No, that's Brother's Keeper.
Yeah, you're right.
Finder's Keeper, I believe, is about a guy who wins an auction for, like, you know, they auction off storage units. And he found a petrified foot
inside. Oh, gosh. That's that Cabinet of Curiosities.
I remember those
things.
And then it's about this guy who's like, I just want my foot back. And then the other guy who won it, he's like, no, this is mine. This is my foot. Just like, wow.
I looked it up. I remember the poster. It's the foot wrapped in like newspaper.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's awful.
That's terrible. The guy didn't want to give the foot back. You're just like, you don't want to give his foot back?
So weird. We usually end our episodes with like recommending episode. What would you recommend to a new viewer for Doctor Who? But I kind of think like Matt already answered that, but this is different.
I may have changed my, I can't remember what I said.
Well, we keep it specific to Modern Who.
That's right. That's right.
And I think you said Blink.
Yes, Blink. I would still say that Blink is quintessentially some of the best moments of Modern Who, and you can watch it without having seen anything else, and you go, "That's a really cool idea. I like that idea." What about you, Vanessa?
I've referred people to Rose the most because that's kind of how I got hooked. And even though there are these weird plastic mannequins, you just like keep watching, just keep watching. I loved Eccleston. I thought he was great. I would definitely recommend the TV movie because I think that's fun. I'm gonna do a third one because it's just so weird, and that is Gridlock.
Yes.
Oh wow.
Gridlock, because I'm so allergic to cats. These people, it's just so such a weird episode. I don't think it will turn people on to Doctor Who, but being in Los Angeles and knowing Gridlock, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's a really, really bizarre episode, but you know, kind of like
strangely, since we last met, I actually like the Rosa Parks episode.
Yes.
With Jodie. I mean, I thought that out of all of the Chibnall stuff, that was quintessential Jodie. It was very much a sort of a family thing. She made the Doctor more family friendly as a general kind of Doctor. And I thought that was one that was fascinating because also it was a historical one. And they don't get done a lot.
I agree.
Really enjoyed that.
Yeah, you can jump in at any time, and that be your first episode. You'll be lucky.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's emotional, you know, as well, you know, and it seemed to sort of affect Jodie's version of the Doctor as well. And I thought that was a strong thing to have. And I think people over the years are going to look back on Jodie's Doctor, and it's going to increase in value and increase in, you know, in its relevance. I think it's going to be something that matures with age as we look back on those seasons that she did.
Yeah.
And then where can we find you? Any reminder that it Doctor Who Am I is premiering March 28th.
It'll be available on all good platforms, but also it'll be available to pre-order on iTunes and Apple TV. The physical media will be available on American Amazon. You can get a Blu-ray now if you are from free region from UK Amazon. You can order that, and if we're coming to your town, you know, get that Blu-ray so you can sort of sign it for you and things, whatever.
And yeah. Clarification, it's, I think, available for purchase to watch. I don't think it's going to be streaming on like Netflix yet.
No, we don't know where it's going to be streaming, but it is going to be, you'll be able to purchase to rent. You'll be able to rent it as well. So you can rent or buy a digital copy. Yes. So it'd be we don't know which platform. I mean, in the UK, it's coming out on BritBox but it's not coming out on the American BritBox. It's coming out on the UK BritBox. So we don't know when exactly that's happening, but it'll be around soon. And then obviously, if anybody's in Boston, and on the 15th of February, they've got nothing better to do. Go to Boston Sci-Fi. Not only are they showing our film, but we've got Time Traveler's Ball that's taking place in the Crystal Ballroom as part. Boston Sci-Fi Film Festival is the oldest genre film festival in America.
Wow.
I think the founding fathers founded it. They were there. We need sci-fi.
And then you'll be at Gallifrey One as well.
Gallifrey one at the end of that week on the 17th. So if you're going to Gallifrey, which I'm sure a lot of the listeners of this podcast are, make sure you're there at 8:30 on Friday evening after the masquerade. Vanessa and I will introduce it. And then on the Saturday, we've got a panel with Ken Deep, likewise talking about the movie. And then on Sunday, we're doing a panel with Chris Chibnall. And that'll be fascinating. Never met him. So that'll be fascinating. So if you're going to Gallifrey, there's lots of joys. It'll be a fascinating Gallifrey, that's for sure.
I thought all your travels were in 2022, but it looks like you got more travels in 2023.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More. You're never like, ends. Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
It never ends.
Conventions we're getting told about. We're like, oh, okay. All right.
So something I didn't want to do in 2015. This has gone on for a long time.
It's taken up a lot of space time.
I've loved it, actually. Time, money, everything. But it's I'm not complaining. It's an honest piece of work. And we've found, you know, some people see themselves in it, which is the important thing.
No, I think that's very important. Like you were talking about, everybody sees something different.
Yeah. It's a great show. I like it. You know, Matthew and I have our little, like, because he's always on the fence a bit. Is he a fan? Is he not a fan? In the documentary.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's his journey.
Well, now I'm a fan.
And I'm always like, I like the show. I like it. Like, looks.
I'm also excited. This is the year of the 60th. So we got a lot of Doctor Who to look forward to this year.
Yes. And isn't it exciting? Shruti Gatwire and the whole, you know, RTD coming back. That'll be exciting. There's so much expectation around his return. I'm really looking forward to seeing what they do with it. I hope it's really fresh. I mean, that's the big point.
I hope it's fun.
Yeah, so do I. I hope it stays fun.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening to us talk with Matthew Jacobs and Vanessa Yule. We hope to see them next time when the future becomes the present.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You just listened to an episode of Who Knew?
Our wonderful theme music is by Michael Grady.
Find him on Facebook at The Universe Explodes.
Additional music is by Damiel Paggio.
All our episodes are engineered by Auburn, and you can find him at auburnbinkley.com.
You can also find this show in several places.
Follow us on Twitter at Who Knew Podcast.
Subscribe, review, and listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher.
Or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast.
All our episodes are on WhoKnewPodcast.com.
Visit our Facebook page.
Please leave comments, reviews, and click like to support Who Knew Podcast.
To listen to our show on your Amazon Echo device, subscribe to us on Amazon Music.
And then ask your Amazon device to play your podcast subscriptions.
This podcast is inspired by Doctor Who,
the longest running sci-fi show in history.
And especially the revival spearheaded by Russell T. Davis.
Thanks to Russell, Sidney Newman,
Verity Lambert, Ron Grainer,
and all those involved in the adventures of our favorite Time Lord.
Your work continues to inspire and entertain.